Welcome back to the Kurdish Research Audio Archive.
Great to be here.
So today we're launching into the material you've shared with us, looking at this fascinating question of how Kurdish history and cultural memory have, you know, managed to survive and be passed down.
Yeah, despite some really significant challenges over the years, it's quite a story of resilience.
Exactly. Our goal here is to really unpack the core strategies the Kurdish people have used to, well, remember, keep, transmit, and sometimes even reconstruct their own historical narratives.
And the document we're working from, Kurdish Historical Memory and Retention, it really lays out how, for a nation estimated at 40 million people but without a state, history isn't just academic.
No, it's much more than that.
It's fundamental. Identity, survival, the ongoing struggle for recognition, for rights, it's all tied up in history.
And you really have to consider the context, don't you? Statelessness, being divided by borders after World War I, that Treaty of Lausanne changing everything.
Superseding earlier possibilities, yeah.
And then the persistent suppression in Turkey, Iran, Iraq, Syria. We're talking forced assimilation, cultural erasure, even linguicide.
Which means that just the act of remembering history, of preserving it.
It becomes political.
Inherently. It turns into a form of resistance against attempts to just wipe the slate clean, you know. Cultural continuity becomes this powerful statement. We exist.
A profound assertion of existence, as the material puts it. So where do we start? The document points heavily towards oral traditions first.
Yes, and that makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
In situations where writing things down was difficult, or maybe even dangerous,
the spoken word had to carry the weight.
It became the primary archive. And for the Kurds, this seems to have been absolutely crucial.
And right at the heart of that, we find the Dengbesh.
Ah, yes.
The name itself. Voice, news, telling, singing. It sort of says it all, doesn't it?
It really does. These are the traditional bards, the storytellers, the singers. For centuries, they've been the custodians of history, legends, epics, the clam, the strand, and that collective memory.
The material calls them living libraries. I love that image.
It's powerful, isn't it?
Yeah.
And often performing a cappella, just the human voice.
That immediacy.
It creates such a direct link to the past. And journalists of their time, another great description.
Yeah, because they weren't just singing old tales. They were documenting current events, social realities, things official histories might ignore or erase.
Exactly. And this tradition, it seems to be ancient, possibly linked to pastoral roots, maybe even older Indo-European bardic practices.
You can almost picture them, can't you? Traveling village to village, performing at gatherings, especially during those long winter nights, the Shevberk.
And the commitment involved. Years of apprenticeship, the sigurti, memorizing vast amounts of material, often without being able to read or write.
It just shows how vital this knowledge was considered.
Absolutely. And their repertoire covered everything. Love, war, heroism, tragedy, local stories, historical events like the Battle of Zilan, figures like Filite Quoto, the whole spectrum of life.
And here's a key point the document stresses. Facing assimilation and linguicide, the Dengbej were crucial guardians of the Kurdish language, especially Kurmanji.
Yes, and of historical consciousness.
Mm.
They connect the past struggles to the present ones.
Mm-hmm.
And because it was intangible, just voice and memory.
Harder to stamp out than books.
Much harder. Though, as the material point out, they certainly didn't escape repression, arrests, imprisonment, particularly in Turkey. It shows how threatening their role was perceived by the state.
And sadly, like many traditions, it's faced challenges from, you know, changing lifestyles, the decline of village life, modern media.
True. But it's really encouraging to see efforts like the Mala Dengbejan, the House of Dengbej, set up in Diyarbakir back in 2007.
Trying to create a space for it.
And similar associations elsewhere. The challenge now is passing it on to younger generations, which often goes hand in hand with language revitalization efforts. But their influence lives on, even inspiring contemporary writers.
So beyond the Dengbej themselves, the document also talks about specific epic poems and stories as being cornerstones.
Yes, these narratives, often originating in oral tradition but sometimes written down later, are like foundational texts for Kurdish identity and historical understanding.
Memuzin comes up immediately. The Kurdish national epic, that tragic romance. Even though Emadezizan wrote it down in the 17th century, its roots are clearly oral.
Deep oral roots, yes. And then you have Dimdim, based on that actual 17th century battle at Dimdim Castle, a powerful symbol of resistance against the Safavids.
And others like Keju Sairbend, another romance, or Zembel Farosh.
The Basket Seller, yeah. These epics explore universal themes, but within a very specific Kurdish cultural context. They entertained, consoled, maybe even healed.
And it definitely solidified that shared identity.
And we shouldn't forget the Kurdish Shahnameh, mostly in Gorani, passed down orally and partly compiled later, distinct from the Persian one.
Right, showing that unique linguistic and cultural stream. And these were often performed by Dengbej too, sometimes with instruments like the timbre.
Absolutely key in weaving that shared cultural fabric.
Okay, so from the spoken word and epic tales, let's shift to music. The document frames Kurdish folk music as another really important carrier of memory.
And resistance, definitely. Passed down orally for generations, it expresses that whole range, history, epics, love, exile, struggle, joy, sorrow.
All the facets of Kurdish experience. We have the klam from the Dengbej strand, which are songs, lowick or laments, dance music.
And again, the voice is central, but with this rich instrumental texture, the blur flute, the mei, the zurna, drums like the dahal and daf, string instruments like the timbre.
Modern instruments get integrated too, right? It's not static.
Not at all. And while there isn't one single system like, say, Arabic maqam, it shares elements, uses microtones, the rhythms are distinctive too, those syncopated beats.
And that Kurmanji singing style, rapid notes on a sustained pitch, then descending, it's very recognizable.
It is. And then you get modern evolutions like Granny from Diyarbakir using the electric bağlama, a really powerful sound for Kurdish youth identity.
Shows that adaptation again. But like the Dengbej, musicians faced terrible repression, didn't they?
Oh, absolutely. Especially in Turkey. People like Shivan Perwar, persecution was real, which made those secretly recorded cassettes and CDs utterly vital.
An underground network of sound, keeping the culture alive.
Precisely. And now, thankfully, we see more formal efforts. Cultural centers, the Dengbej houses, archives like the KMHE in Erbil, trying to preserve this musical heritage.
It shapes both that day-to-day communicative memory and the bigger cultural memory, the shared heritage, and for the diaspora.
Music is often that primary emotional link back home, a really powerful connector.
So pulling this thread together, the oral traditions, the epics, the music, the document, really highlights how dynamic this relationship is.
It's not like oral stops when writing starts. They feed each other. Oral forms gave material for classical literature modern writers draw on Dengbej.
And despite all the efforts to erase them, these traditions have shown incredible resilience, adapting, surviving.
Proving just how effective they are as tools of cultural survival and, yes, resistance for a people without a state.
Which leads us naturally to the written word itself. While oral traditions were the bedrock, writing has also played a huge part, shaped by those same political constraints.
Yeah, the journey from parchment to print, as the material puts it, is fascinating. You see the influence of surrounding literary cultures, Arabic, Persian, Turkish.
But Kurdish writing emerges. The first proper text identified is that 15th century prayer in Armenian script. Though there might be earlier bits, the dating's debated.
Right. But substantial literature really gets going from the 16th, 17th centuries, often flourishing in the Kurdish principalities, the emirates, and the madrasas.
And we see these key figures in classical Kurmanji literature, like Malay Siziri foundational, they say.
Very much so. And his student, Fikiye Tehran, using the Mathnawi form for narrative poems.
And then, of course, Emet İzani. Can't talk about Kurdish literature without him. Mehmet Uzun, obviously. But also his teaching works, religious poems.
He's central. And others followed, like Mela Hüseyin Ebatay, known for his Malud. A really rich period.
The document also makes a point about the separate Gorani literary tradition, under the Ardalans, potentially the oldest written Kurdish tradition.
That's the argument, yeah.
Yeah.
Using that dicasyllabic meter. Figures like Balul, Mele Perişan, and notably the female poet and historian Mestura Ardalan.
It functioned as a kind of literary common language, a Koine, for a while.
It did, before Sorani gained prominence later on.
Which happened more around the Baban Emirate, Sulaymaniyah, late 18th, early 19th century.
Exactly, with poets like Nali setting the standard, compiling the first major diwan or collection, and Selim, his contemporary, sometimes writing about historical events.
And later poets like Haji Kadir Koyi bringing in more patriotic themes, praising Kurdish history, and Sufi influences with poets like Mawi. It's quite an evolution across dialects.
It really is. And then as we move into the 20th century, prose starts to really take off alongside poetry.
Connected to journalism, political movements, the first newspaper in Cairo, 1898, early journals publishing the first short stories.
And the historical novel becomes really significant from the mid-20th century, a way to reclaim those silent histories, explore key moments. Writers like Ali Abdul Rahman, Jan Dosch.
Using fiction to grapple with history, oppression, resistance. Mm-hmm. The document mentions Republic of Dreams dealing with recent history.
Yeah, it's a powerful tool for shaping national consciousness. Mm-hmm. Modern poetry also shifts, becomes more overtly political, dealing with nationalism, exile. Sig Rukswin is a huge name here.
Along with so many others. Abdullah Goran, Osman Sabri, Hejar, Hemin, Pashu, Bakhtir Ali, Sarah Omar. And translations start coming in from the 1930s.
And it feels like much of this modern literary development was driven by, well, political necessity.
Mm.
Codifying identity, preserving memory, building consciousness against assimilation.
Often in exile, as you said.
Which brings us right to the Hawar generation, a really crucial moment.
This diaspora surge after the crackdown in Turkey.
Yes. The journal Hawar, published out of Damascus from 1932, Saladet Ali Bedirksen's project. Its aims were clear. Cultivate and standardize Kurmanji, boost literacy, collect folklore, foster national identity.
And the huge innovation, the Latin-based Hawar alphabet, the Bedirksen alphabet, now standard for Kurmanji in many places.
Revolutionary. And May 15th, its first publication date, is now Kurdish Language Day. That shows its impact.
The journal covered so much original writing, folklore, history, grammar, translations, even religious texts. A very broad, liberal outlook.
Key writers involved the Bedirksen brothers, Kadri Khan, Sigurdsson, Osman Sabri, Nureddin Zaza. Its influence spread to later journals, too, like Gelawej in Iraq and Nudim in Sweden.
A real watershed moment for written Kurdish. But this leads to the question of preservation archives. The document paints a difficult picture here.
Extremely difficult. No unified state means no central national archive. Materials are scattered across the archives of the states Kurds live in, plus former colonial powers. And access is often heavily restricted.
So even if things were written down, finding and preserving them is another battle. We have early chronicles like the Sharafnama.
By Sharaf Khan Bidlisi, yeah. But systematic collection, hampered by repression, conflict, censorship, displacement, deliberate destruction. Think of Anfal or recent conflicts. Confiscation of archives, too.
It's devastating. And the practical challenges, lack of funds, expertise, storage, instability, security risks... documents just decaying.
But there's a positive shift, noted this archival turn. Community members, activists, academics becoming much more proactive.
Trying to locate, preserve, provide access. We see private archives emerging. Digitization projects like the Endangered Archives Program.
Institutions in Kurdistan, like the Kurdish Heritage Institute, the Zine Center, and online platforms are Vital Kurdopedia, the Kurdistan Memory Program.
These digital archives offer a way around some physical limitations, don't they?
Absolutely. They offer resilience, global access. The state of the archives really mirrors the Kurdish situation, so building them, especially digitally, is itself an act of resistance, of reclaiming the past.
Oh, Hannah the Chai Lady is here, Roj Bashan.
Oh, perfect timing.
Let's see. Takes a sip. A bit bitter today. Definitely needs a touch more sugar. But still, a welcome pause in our discussion.
Always good to have chai. Short pause.
Okay, welcome back. We needed that little break. So we've covered the spoken word, the written word, music. Now the document shifts focus to how history is also, well, embodied in cultural practices, symbols, even landscapes.
Right, these aren't just background elements. They actively carry and express historical memory and identity. And often, they become more significant precisely because they're contested or suppressed.
Newroz is the prime example, isn't it? The Kurdish New Year, around the spring equinox, ancient Zoroastrian roots.
But for Kurds, it's layered with meaning. Rebirth, hope, freedom overcoming tyranny. The legend of Kawa the blacksmith defeating Zahak is absolutely central.
Lighting those bonfires on the hillsides, Kawa's signal of victory. It's a celebration of liberation.
And the rituals reinforce that. Jumping over the flames for purification, the big public gatherings with traditional dance, howl park, or govan singing, poetry, wearing traditional clothes, special foods.
It's a huge community event. But as the document emphasizes, it became increasingly politicized in the 20th century.
Very much so. A key symbol of national identity against assimilation attempts in Turkey, Iran, Iraq, Syria. Governments often banned it or tried to control it.
Which, paradoxically, often made it even more potent. Clandestine celebrations, confrontations, acts of defiance like Mazlum Dosan's self-immolation in prison on Newroz Eve in 82.
Moments like that cemented its symbolic power.
Okay.
So just participating, even just wearing the traditional clothes or colors associated with Kurdish identity, becomes a political statement during Newroz. Its importance echoes through Kurdish poetry, old and new.
Speaking of clothes, traditional Kurdish clothing, Silivrisin Kurdi, another powerful, visible marker.
Absolutely. Worn especially during celebrations like Newroz or weddings, it's a conscious act of affirming identity and heritage.
And there's so much regional diversity in the styles, reflecting local environments, maybe tribal links, but common threads too.
For women, you often see those long, brightly colored dresses, Kira's fistem with embroidery, the baggy trousers or shalwar underneath, vests or jackets, the wide belts, and incredibly varied headwear.
And for men, the distinctive baggy trousers, shalu, shepik shirts, vests, the wide sash or peshtwen, and the different styles of turban or head wrap, like the semidani.
Historically, colors and quality could signal status, age, marital status, the occasion. It's a language and fabric connecting people to their ancestors and cultural values.
It faces challenges, of course, modernization, globalization, cost, assimilation policies trying to discourage it. But there seems to be a resurgence of interest.
Definitely, especially among younger generations and in the diaspora. Designers are reviving styles.
Yeah.
And the fact that neighbors sometimes try to claim these designs as their own just highlights their political weight as distinctly Kurdish.
It really does. Then we have woven narratives, motifs, and art and crafts, especially carpets and kilims.
Gleam weaving, primarily done by women, passed down mother to daughter. It's far more than just craft. It's encoding memory, values, identity.
The document notes distinct features. Local wool, hand spinning, natural dyes giving those vibrant colors, specific knotting techniques, bold geometric designs reflecting nomadic roots and nature.
And the symbols woven in are just incredible. Motifs for fertility, ram's horns, pomegranates, for marriage hairbands, earrings, for protection hands, amulets, evil eye designs.
Motifs representing life, spirituality, water paths, stars, mythology, Shamaran, the snake queen, maybe even tribal or regional identifiers in the patterns.
Exactly. The weavers embed stories, passing down this symbolic language. And the act of weaving itself builds community. But like traditional clothing, it's under threat.
Conflict, displacement, people settling down, state suppression, cheap factory goods, assimilation. The skills and the knowledge, the motifs are at risk.
And sadly, during hard times, like under sanctions in Iraq, families had to sell priceless heritage rugs just to survive. But the influence persists in other arts, and there are efforts to preserve it.
Finally, in this section, the significance of place. Landmarks, archaeological sites, buildings, natural features as anchors for memory.
The land itself holds history. Think of the ancient citadels like Erbil or Diyarbakir's walls, fortresses like Dimdim or Hushap, prehistoric sites like Shanidar Cave.
Religious sites are crucial too, Lelish, for Yazidis, monasteries, mosques, shrines across different faiths reflecting Kurdistan's diverse history, iconic bridges.
And sites of modern memory, the Enfal Monument, places like Mahabad, Halabja, the site of the Emu Day Cinema Fire. Plus, new cultural institutions being built.
These aren't just static locations. They're active sites of memory-making, but being physical makes them vulnerable.
Extremely vulnerable. Damage from conflict, deliberate destruction by groups like ISIS or during state operations, neglect. Heritage sites often become battlegrounds for competing narratives. Preservation is a constant struggle.
So these embodied forms, practices, clothing, crafts, places, they're active resistance. But the tangible ones are fragile, especially without state protection. Vulnerable to destruction, displacement, erasure.
It's that recurring theme of statelessness impacting every facet of preservation, which leads us nicely into the role of the diaspora.
Yes, the document stresses how vital the diaspora is. Forced displacement, tragically, created new centers for culture and politics outside the homeland.
The diaspora didn't just start recently. There were historical deportations centuries ago. But the modern diaspora in the West really kicked off in the 1960s with labor migration from Turkey.
Then waves of refugees followed from Iran after 79, Turkey in the 80s and 90s, Iraq under the Ba'athists, and during Anfal, Syria more recently.
Resulting in large communities, especially in Western Europe, Germany, France, Sweden, the UK, maybe over 2 million there, North America, Australia too. Kurds from Turkey often form the largest group.
And it's often called a stateless diaspora, right? Deeply connected to the politics back home.
Very much so. So how do they preserve culture abroad? Cultural centers, education, publications are key.
Countless Kurdish institutes and associations have sprung up. Hubs for community, culture, support, advocacy, like the Kurdish Institute of Paris, centers in Berlin, local groups everywhere.
Education is vital too, fighting language loss, teaching history and culture, community schools, summer programs, even links with the KRG Ministry of Education for schools abroad. plus university Kurdish studies programs.
And publications flourished in exile when they couldn't at home. Sweden became a major publishing hub, journals like Nudum carrying on that Hawar legacy, vital for language, literature, knowledge sharing.
Then came the internet, the digital hearth, a game changer for a dispersed community.
Online forums, social media groups. Suddenly, Kurds scattered across the globe could connect, discuss, share memories, build virtual community in unprecedented ways.
And digital archiving became crucial given how vulnerable physical materials are. We mentioned some initiatives earlier, the Kurdistan Memory Program, KMP, Kurdipedia, the Exeter Digital Archive.
Partipedia focusing on political groups. Even early websites faced censorship, showing the power of these online spaces.
These digital archives are resilient against destruction, accessible globally. They help build that transnational Kurdish consciousness, that imagined community.
Life in diaspora is a constant negotiation of identity, isn't it? Shaped by memories of home, realities of the host country. Collective memory oppression, displacement resistance becomes core to being Kurdish abroad.
And it evolves. The first generation has direct memories. Later generations inherit them but filter them through their own experiences, navigating hybrid identities, sometimes losing the language.
Cultural production art, writing, music, film, curating becomes a key way for diaspora Kurds to explore all this. Reclaiming heritage, shaping identity, gaining visibility, building solidarity, challenging policies.
The diaspora has arguably become a major engine for contemporary Kurdish culture, precisely because of restrictions at home. Think of the Latin alphabet via Hawar, much modern literature, the institutes, academic studies, mostly happened in diaspora settings.
Digital tech just amplified that, creating this resilient transnational network of memory and knowledge.
Which brings us to the more formal academic side of things. Institutional initiatives, studying, documenting, preserving Kurdish history.
Kurdish studies as an academic field has grown a lot, especially in Europe and North America, linked to diaspora activism and realizing how neglected this history was.
Universities now have dedicated centers. Exeter Center for Kurdish Studies with its library and archives, the Zahra Institute in the U.S., programs at Uppsala, Central Florida, and others. Even inside Turkey, Mardin Artuklu University started a department, though it's complex politically. Research uses all sorts of methods. Gets published in journals like Kurdish Studies, books like The Cambridge History of the Kurds, a growing body of scholarship.
And alongside academia, what about museums and archives specifically focused on heritage? We touched on the challenges.
It's fragmented, yes. Relies on the KRG in Iraq, NGOs, universities, private collectors, diaspora groups, often struggles with funding, expertise. Big international museums haven't always given Kurdish heritage its due. But there are important initiatives in Kurdistan, the Kurds Heritage Museum, the Textile Museum in Erbil, the planned Big Kurdistan Museum designed by Labskind, which will host the KMP Digital Archive.
Institutes like KHI and Zine Center in Sulaymaniyah doing vital work, collaborating internationally. Digitization projects.
University archives holding unique collections like Exeter's. And those digital archives we keep mentioning, KMP, Kurdipedia, Exeter's Deem Project, plus community archives in the diaspora.
Media plays a role too, right? Broadcasting, publishing.
Definitely. TV channels, where allowed, show cultural programs, Ding Bay performances, Kurdsat, TRT Kurdi, though state-controlled, diaspora media. Publishing houses in Kurdistan and abroad print books on history, folklore, literature. Online news platforms report on preservation, research.
But this formalization isn't without issues, the document suggests.
No, it brings complexities. Standardization, deciding what gets into the canon, funding choices, who gets to curate the story in a museum. These involve power dynamics, politics of representation, whose history gets told, whose gets left out.
So success often depends on bridging those gap, collaboration between Kurdistan and the diaspora, overcoming the limits of being stateless and divided.
Exactly. Which leads us, finally, to the obstacles themselves. The flip side of resilience is the constant pressure against memory.
And the root cause identified is statelessness itself. The lack of unifying national institutions, a government, a national archive, museums, an education system to protect heritage.
Plus the political and geographical fragmentation. Borders cutting through communities, different levels of repression in each part. Lack of citizenship rights for some, like Syrian Kurds historically. Even diaspora Kurds can feel precarious.
Then there's the active politics of erasure, state suppression, assimilation policies, linguicide.
States often see Kurdish identity as a threat. So they try to absorb Kurds into the dominant identity, changing place names, discouraging Kurdish names, resettlement, denying Kurdish history exists, Mountain Turks theory, etc.
And language suppression has been central decades of bans in Turkey on speaking or writing Kurdish in public, no Kurdish education or media allowed for long periods.
Cultural suppression, too, targeting clothing, music, folklore, Newroz, confiscating materials, it's been systematic.
And the physical scars displacement and the destruction of cultural heritage, deep wounds.
Forced displacement is a recurring trauma. Ottomans, Safavids, modern states, Iraq's Arabization, Anfal, Turkey's village destructions in the 80s, 90s, recent conflicts. Uprooting people disrupts everything, including oral transmission.
Villages destroyed, homes lost. Anfal saw maybe 90% of Kurdish villages in affected areas destroyed, thousands cleared by Turkey.
And cultural heritage sites deliberately damaged or destroyed in conflicts. Anfal, Iran-Iraq war, ISIS targeting Yazidi sites, Turkish operations in Rojava, urban warfare damaging places like Diyarbakir's old city.
Instability also fuels looting, illicit trade in antiquities, and even environmental destruction dams. Deforestation impacts heritage tied to the land.
These challenges all feed into each other. Lack of state protection makes communities vulnerable to suppression, which sparks resistance, leading to conflict, causing displacement and destruction, further weakening communities. It's a vicious cycle.
And erasure isn't accidental. It's often a deliberate strategy to undermine identity and resistance.
Precisely. It makes the efforts to remember and preserve all the more remarkable and vital.
As we wrap up this exploration, it's just incredibly clear, isn't it? The Kurdish people have shown extraordinary resilience in holding on to their past against truly immense odds.
Absolutely. From the Dengbe's voice to modern digital archives, from woven carpets to academic studies, it's this multifaceted, adaptable web of memory practices.
And they're all interconnected. Oral inspires written, culture gets studied, diaspora helps homeland, digital tools connect everyone. It's dynamic.
And despite everything, statelessness, suppression, displacement, destruction, that tenacity of historical consciousness is such a powerful counter-narrative. Remembering in all these forms is absolutely core to Kurdish identity and the ongoing struggle for cultural life and political rights.
It's clear that preserving and passing on this history isn't just about looking back. It's fundamental for the present and the future. We hope this overview has offered some valuable insights into this incredible story of endurance.
What really stands out looking at all this is perhaps that constant interplay between vulnerability and tenacious creativity.
That's a great way to put it. For our listeners, what questions does this raise for you about how memory functions under pressure? What other examples of cultural resilience come to mind? Something to think about as we continue to explore this rich history.